Welcome back. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Yeah, where my mind goes with that is like, I guess a little tool nugget thing. Is I read in like a Buddhist text of like, when we're feeling that pain, we dedicate that pain to, I guess, all sentient beings of like, I'm gonna feel this pain so nobody else has to feel it. So you kind of dedicate it to like the universe or to all people.
I don't know where that comes from, man, but I do not agree with that at all. I do not know where that idea comes from.
I might be butchering it, but it might be
Yeah,
something.
I'm not, maybe I've never heard that, but my reflex is, why would I want to stop people from having access to how toolboxes are made?
Right.
Because now, I mean, and I'm just playing this because I don't, I think you probably just sort of maybe hijacked some Buddhist stuff in a way that maybe is a contemporary thing.
Potentially, yeah.
But let's say you and I are ancestors now, sitting in what I'm going to call the sky world, just assuming there's still a point of perception beyond life. And we're looking down at humanity with the wisdom of, let's say we both did some sage-like thing while we were here and kind of figured some stuff out. And there we are sitting one manifold beyond causality and day-to-day life. And we could reach in there and take all the pain in the world away. We are addiction. We are the devil incarnate because now we can numb the world. So no one ever has to learn, grow, heal, or become a whole. We have just taken the primary medicine of life away from life. I think people would just all lie down and give up because there'd be no point. All I have is pleasure, pleasure this, pleasure that, pleasure everywhere, and nothing means anything anymore. So that this is, I'm glad we're having this conversation because the understanding I have of I think where you're coming from, and this isn't my understanding versus your understanding. I'm not a Buddhist, so I don't even pretend to have an actual, like, I'm saying from an authoritative place of, something. I'm just like, the way I remember that is if life has suffering in it and you can bring conscious awareness to suffering, the suffering actually is just pain. And if you can actually find the wherewithal to bring conscious awareness to pain, now you have a teacher. Because now you can discover the true nature of compassion, which is to suffer with. I don't think anywhere in that paradigm it says make it go away. And this is where we have to warrior up a bit and say, you're right. I don't want it to go away. I want it to be right where it's supposed to be. Just like the dashboard lights of your car, I need this to navigate my life. Otherwise, I am just an adolescent sucking at the nipple of pleasure until I die, which has zero meaning and honestly, for me, zero interest. Like, well, I'd be out of a job on many levels, right?
Yeah. There goes your life's work.
Well, I mean, it's also like all these traditions that I've been, studying with and gathering. Their entire ethos is warrior up to be with the vicissitudes of fate, the visceral, the instinctual, the existential pain. Because why else? Where did all these skills come from? I wasn't fat, bored pleasure seekers, that's for sure.
Yeah. We needed them.
Yeah, because they went towards the pain, towards the overwhelm, right? And that's the beauty of it. I think this because I mean, Eastern philosophy often comes across as band-aids everywhere in the West, until you really hang out with like real teachers who are like, yeah, well, that's just kind of like the brochure to get people in the door. You want to get them warmed up with some practice, some good feelings, some happy thoughts, and then you want to turn around and like unlock the basement where the work starts. Right? Otherwise, it's spiritual bypassing, and that's been going on for ever, everywhere. Think of all the feng shui in Chinese selling fancy, elixirs off the back of a wagon. You ever see this in the old cowboy movies? You can buy Dr. McGill cut his pain-free snake oil. It'll make all your feelings just disappear. It's like, yeah, well, Snake oil's been around for a while.
Yeah, definitely many versions of that one.
So I'm not sure about you as a Qigong teacher, but I don't want to be a snake oil salesman. So,
Negatory, I'm gonna pass on that one.
right. So let's go back a week ago. There you were. What really happened?
I don't know in which context you're asking, like the actual experience of like what actually happened.
Well, in the context of the paradigm we share.
Sure. So, basically, I was going through, I spent a few weeks working on a specific aspect or a pattern, and I had this moment where I was finally free from it, like probably like 1 or 2 hours or something. I don't even know how long it was, because like what came after was like it's just overrode that experience. But I was free from it for like a small period of time, and then.
Before you move on, are you comfortable sharing the context of that? Like, what if you were to do it in the context of a very short story sentiment? Like, what were you actually moving through as a person? And if you don't want to share that, that's cool.
I don't know the exact context, but it was around shame and I guess humiliation. Yeah. And actually I made a word in this, and I call it in humiliation, because like there was no humiliation on the outside, but there was a whole bunch of it on the inside. And so yeah, that was the emotion. So there's like humiliation's really tied to like I guess what you call like the seething rage.
Yeah, that's the one.
And yeah, those two things are kind of there. So yeah, so I kind of moved through a part of that, and I was kind of free from it. And then I don't even know what triggered it. And then it just triggered in a big way, like bigger than it's ever triggered before. And it just, yeah, I went deep into that seething rage of just like, oh, like fuck my practice, fuck all this, like I'm done, I don't want to do this anymore, this is too much. And then on went the spiral of going down that path. And then when I realized what I was doing, I was already knee-deep in 3 4 days of sugar addiction and all the coffee I could drink, and just like I was. And then my vitality was gone because of that. And so then it was like this, like, okay, now how do I get back here? So I was like kind of just trying to navigate my world of like, okay, well, the one thing I know I can do is I can stop eating sugar. And so I stopped eating sugar, and I slowly started like climbing that pedestal. And then I was like, okay, well, maybe no carbs either. Okay, slowly. Okay. And then I kept the coffee, and I kind of went more into like a ketogenic style diet. And
Oh,
then that
nice.
gave me the space, because like I wasn't hitting that button as often. And so then I started bringing some space into it. And then
Nice.
eventually, I guess in dramatic fashion, I'm crawling on my hands and knees to like get to my chair so I can put one arm up on it so I can maybe sit, and eventually get to a place where I'm actually just sitting and being with it.
So can I put a layer next to that or a parallel thing next to that?
Sure.
I'm grateful we're having this conversation because I'm kind of recapitulating something that's a part of my conditioning, which is not an excuse. I'm just exploring this with you, and this is how intimacy works, right? Like, oh, I didn't really see it that way or feel it that way. I'm just noticing how often I humiliate the people around me in a very gentle but slightly passive aggressive way. Because martial arts teachers have done that with me since I was a kid to try and motivate me to try harder or to stop being distracted or to do what they want me to do. So they'll create a situation where I mean, martial arts, you can be humiliated by being laughed at, but you can also have someone just overwhelm you with their skill set because they're obviously better than you. You're learning from them and physically, mentally, or emotionally humiliate them or, have them do that to me or me to do that to other people to try and make them use their anger or their assertion or their purpose the way you want. And I can think of the times I've done that with my kid or, with partners in my life where I'm trying to win an argument in some way. And instead of being really clear with that in myself and within the conversation, finding something to pick at and, I'll call it humiliation light to kind of point out the flaws in something, because I want, without saying it, them to behave and value the same thing I do so that I can make them change. Right? Because that's like we're always trying to collaborate and move forward. And if we're not collaborating consciously in that intimacy sense of let's discover what's not being seen or felt here, then we'll run with a status quo thing of like, well, I'll push against that thing until it hurts enough that you'll seek escape or another avenue of behavior. And then maybe in the short term, one person wins at that. And this is a part of sacred intimacy in couples, is to realize how passive aggressive manipulation is sort of the status quo of how we try and organize forward movement. Without talking about forward movement, we talk about, I'm going to pick on what's wrong with this or with you or with that until you feel humiliated or ashamed enough to viscerally want to escape that feeling. And hopefully, if I get it just right, you'll or they or me will jump in the direction that seems like the positive movement. But that's like four different kinds of negative that leave scars, wounds, and maybe a bit of rage or seething rage, to try and get through an argument or to try and get a person to agree to do something else. Right. And that's something that's innate in Western culture and especially modern kind of relationship dynamics, is instead of let's stop the car, pull out, pull over, get out, stretch, talk about how we're getting where we're going and why we're going in that direction at all, we'll just do shitty things to each other until the other person stops doing the thing or changes it to the thing you wanted to, or you just stop talking to each other because we're not actually even communicating in the first place. Right. And given that we all have that capacity through the way movies and television and romance novels teach us to not actually communicate, no, notice that on a certain level, that's what you were doing with yourself. Right. You went through a hard time, you found relief, and relief, unfortunately, frees us from the consequence pain dynamic, and then we collapse. Because now what? So we find something to compensate for by compensating. And then being addictive, and then finding shame, and then finding rage, and then we're back to the, play the circus music now because. We're back as sort of a shame-based circus performer in the causality of life. I mean, one of the most painful things we'll ever do is stop using pain. Because now what? Because the opposite of pain isn't pleasure.
Explain that one a little bit.
Well, I'm leaving that out in my passive-aggressive manipulative way, like little breadcrumbs. Come on, Rabbi, catch up. Figure it out. What do you think it is? What is the opposite of pain if it's not pleasure?
Love.
Well, let's say it starts with a P just for fun.
I have no idea.
Peace. Now, if you live in a culture that keeps you in a highly anticipatory, compensatory state all of the time, and someone says, here's some peace, who are you? It doesn't matter anymore, does it? Like who you are, your skill set, your toolbox, because in peace, none of that stuff matters anymore. There's an existential pain that people go through in spiritual practice when you find peace, because the pain is your ego and your toolbox are no longer really that thing. And then who are you? Like what does a Ravi need to be when there's peace?
Yeah, especially because you spent like all this time and effort and energy, like almost a life's work to like build that thing, right?
I've been fighting the good fight for decades. And when I get to the peace place, I'm like, I'm completely useless. Like Michael, all of his skills, doctor, save lives, warrior, martial arts guy, badass with a sticker, a pencil for movie reference. And I'm just like, I'm the most useless piece of crap ever, because I'm designed for like high level consequence. Like, what do I do in peace? Like, Maybe I'll just go stir up some stuff so I can find something to be like angry with or, compassionate with in the Doctor Warrior sense, I think it's hilarious. My life is like this almost bipolar thing of like compassionate doctor, scary fighter guy, and then in the middle, like the Taoist monk kind of like, yeah. If I'm successful at any of this stuff, I'm irrelevant. Oh, holy crap. Like, what have I done? But that's true of the whole dynamic, is we have to build momentum, break free of patterns, and then discover what it is to be in the intimacy beyond reaction, beyond the overwhelm. Like being with peace is its own little bit of egoic agony.
Very interesting.
Right? And that's why overwhelm is so hard. Because it's self-defining. And if you can resolve your overwhelm, you don't need yourself anymore. And oh my God, now what?
The Tao.
So let's just check our list just to make sure we've, I don't know, accomplished our menu of
Ooh,
context.
so one thing I did want to share was the actual story there, I think, which is what you're alluding to, was that I had ruined my practice and all the work that I'd put in was no longer valid, and I'm gonna have to walk away from the lineage, and and Mike's gonna be so mad at me because I'm not practicing, and it's been 2 weeks, and it's right on the verge of this 49-day practice, and here I am in like not practicing for 2 weeks, and like it was just, yeah, that was my chaos. It was. And it's not the first time I've been there.
Well, it's not the last either. Like I'm expecting a good 10 more of those, before I'm, presuming there's still a me, to be with all that. So.
So yeah, our list, we have intimacy, cognitive, visceral, dissociation, trauma, and free states, addiction and compensatory behavior, kind of wrapped together with shame. I did write a few more things,
Oh, nice.
actually. And I think we're gonna get to the medicine part of this. So we have two places we can go with this. One is like the loss of elders in our modern world. And the other side that I was kind of just curious about is, yeah, we have like these healing sounds and sweat lodge sounds. But like in these Eastern traditions, we have like devotional music. So I was wondering how that would tie in. And then I also wrote gaslighting, which is kind of a word for like
Oh man.
can we go to gaslighting? I feel like we could go there.
So throw a good definition of gaslighting so we can
So
kind of
as I see
process.
it or as I perceive it, it's like we don't honor someone's experience as it is, but we tell them that this is what it is, and then we shame them for having, being, or saying, or doing a certain thing, or being a certain way.
I would agree with that. I would just change one word. It isn't what they're doing, it's what it means.
Okay, that brings
Right?
depth.
Because I think gaslighting, I mean, it can be a lot of things, but what you're really trying to do is manipulate what meaning is with people and to say your sense of meaning is wrong. This is what this means. That's the bad meaning. That's the immature meaning. That's the shitty meaning. That's the unpopular meaning. If you want the good meaning, though, this is what you have to do. Because what that meant to you isn't real, right? And what it means to me is real, right? And that's how, say, abusive people get away with things is like, hey, this is what I was really doing, but how you took that is wrong, right? And you don't take an experience right or wrong, you take what it means right or wrong, right? And I wouldn't even say it's right or wrong, I would just say you take what it means viscerally, because that's where the existential and the visceral meet is in meaning. We can often say the mind and body meet in sensation, but the spirit and the animal body meet in meaning, which is what keeps us going.
I would have never put those things together, but it fits there like a puzzle piece.
Yeah, right. So if what we're looking for with gaslighting is to manipulate meaning, we have kind of two choices in at least in Shuadao and Taoist practice, which is go into the most authentic, the Chen, the character with the cooking your ego until the beauty comes out. We can sit in that state as a state, not as an outcome, but as a state until we come to a real coherent, like visceral, instinctual, deeper, Yuan Shen, like origin sense of experience and consciousness. There's going to be a meaning tone, a feeling tone to that that is the real you. Right, which isn't the ego story you, it's the one living life you, right? And in the context of your culture, your time, your work, your family, that you and that meaning is it has to be contextual to the life you're living, or else it's just ideation. And almost a lot of spiritual stuff is kind of like gaslighting because it's designed to tell you that this is what it should mean, and it was written by somebody 2,000 years ago who didn't live with a phone, dopamine addict device next to your face every day. So we have to be, I think, a little bit mindful of trying to use other cultures' prehistoric sense of meaning to squeeze, our mind into a modern life and presume they're both parallel or equal to each other. So let's be careful not to gaslight our gaslighting with other people's gaslighting from 2,000 years ago. If you're going to find meaning, it's going to be when you're at peace and in truth and moving beyond the egoic self in your life right frickin' now. And it's a tone of feeling, it's not a story. And I think that's also where we get meaning misconstrued. Now I'm gaslighting people about the meaning of meaning, right? Because I just did that in a funny way. And I'm not telling people what meaning is to them. I'm just suggesting maybe we can redefine meaning from a story you could tell to a state you can arrive in that will get you through every problem in your life, because that's the state. It's like we called zongqi in the chest in Taoist practice, even in some older Chinese medicine. Between your heart and stomach is a space. We have zuqiao, the aperture to the ancestral raw. How they got through everything they got through to get you here is how you're going to gut into your own life to get you through what you have to get through to get your offspring or your culture or, whatever echoes you leave in the world beyond yourself. Right. So when we talk about that in martial arts, you have to gut in. You have to, do you have the guts to deal with that? Because if you don't go into the back alley to rescue that person. You're just going to be victim number two. And guts isn't ego. Guts is a place in your body, right? So zuqiao, the aperture to your ancestor, zongqi, the influence your ancestors still have echoing through you in this breath, we find residing right in the center of your butterflies. That's why they're there. You up to this? No. Okay, good. You up to this? Yes. Okay. Well, the yes and the no states are the difference between butterflies and bring it on. Right. So if go
There's
ahead.
quite a bit of work that has to be done there to get to the bring it on place. I
Yeah.
guess
Yeah.
depending on the life you've lived.
And especially when your teacher says, oh, yeah, and now you can take on the pain of 8 billion people and then the multiverse. Right. So we go back to this, started with gaslighting in a way between the existential, esoteric, and the visceral. Is a state that we could describe as meaningful. It's the bring it on warrior state, which is the state you need to be in meditation. And that's why we sometimes talk about trauma in the Neidan, well, what I teach, which is sort of the beginning of Neidan, as a thread that connects your three dantian that you cannot affect from the post-heaven world or existence. You can only lure the pre-heaven into it, the ancestral, the what makes you possible. But it's not up to you to configure that or contrive that. It's up to you to call on aspects of yourself that you can't flirt with or manipulate or contrive. It's there's parts of us that are before the mind.
So I think in one of the first classes that I had with you, and when you were describing that, and I use these words that I quote, an endless path that nobody gets to put their feet on.
And that's the, I mean, sometimes I kind of complain a little bit about modern, especially Neidan teachers, or some people call it Neigong, because they keep discounting all of the hard work at the beginning because they're beyond it themselves. So they just want to tell people, oh, you don't really need to do that, just do this, because they're at that point in their practice now. And then they tell other people, well, this is where like the real practice happens. And it's like, you only got there after 20 years of doing a bunch of what like seem now like silly things. And then they talk about them. And I see this even quoted in some of the, I don't know, last 1,000 years in Taoism, where they talk about it being side hustles and side journeys and side doors, and they're shaming the stuff that got them to where they could actually say that, as if it's irrelevant, but it got them to the point where they could actually go, yeah, you don't really need that at a certain point. But instead of saying that, they say, oh, that's just garbage. But it's like, oh yeah, that's how did you learn how to get where you are? Well, on a mountain of garbage. Oh, okay, cool. Let's just be clear then about what maybe some honesty and less gaslighting might
Yeah.
mean. Pardon me for layering my puns.
It's like that little bit of ego snuck in the back door there.
Because that's where we're at. And this goes to the elder thing. The reason why the loss of elders and adults in the world is a crisis is we don't know how to model. And we're primates, so we learn to behave by modeling other people, right? There's I don't know, I don't want to get too personalistic, but for reasons you can intuit if you choose to, I sometimes love watching people on YouTube who live in neurodivergent couples who deal with the unique challenges of being in a neurodivergent couple and some of the terminology that happens within that. And there's usually a neurodivergent couples, one person is going to, by conscious choice or by default, start behaving in a way that allows the other person to recognize through the behavior how to shift something. Because in certain capacities around what we call neurodivergence, certain behaviors aren't automatic or defaulted. They're ones that are just sort of like just out of the realm of like a natural decision tree. So if one of the persons in that, couple or union or collaboration recognizes that, like kind of jump starting a car or something or push starting a car, if one of us starts behaving in a certain way, the other person will pick up on, oh, that's exactly what should be happening, but we have to kind of push start it almost unconsciously. Right. I mean, they call that in the neurodivergent sense, body doubling, where one person, say, starts to do the dishes and then everybody wants to do the dishes. But until that momentum begins, it's just a pile of dishes, right? So it's not a story about who should or shouldn't be doing anything at any time about anything. It's about noticing, as an example, sometimes we need a body double to model a behavior. Right now, I'm using a very specific example because that's a part of my reality, and it's kind of funny if you ever want to go on YouTube and type in like neurodivergent couples and body doubling, because it's very funny to watch how that unravels as we figure these things out. Now, I'm also going to say the same thing from a different context completely. Having an Indigenous background and spending a lot of my adult life around elders who deserve that term because of the lives they've lived. They will not tell me anything. In fact, one of my elders laughingly waited 15 years and laughed in my face with glee and joy that I finally asked the question. He'd been waiting 15 years for me to ask, because we have this ethic of non-interference, which is you'll get it when you're ready, you'll see it when you're ready. Because similar to bodily doubling and how to get the dishes done in one context, is how modeling has always worked in cultures, including Taoism, that embrace the ethic of non-interference, which is I'll behave skillfully and you will model this behavior until you figure out the why and the meaning for yourself. Right? And it's not that we're imitating in some fake way, like I'm pretending to be Beyonce or something. Some mimicking behavior. Modeling is trying to understand how and why a person does what they do by doing similar things until you actually go, oh, now I'm that person. So that's the big challenge in modern Qigong Taoist practice, is we don't have a culture and a community that that gives us consistent access to model the behavior and choices and meanings of elders and teachers and masters in the real sense of master. And Shifu does not mean master. It means basically someone who adopts you for a minimum of 10 years and takes responsibility for the outcome. I would love to make that like a some kind of karmic commitment that everyone who uses the term master or sifu or shifu, that they are now, based on some magical, I don't know, accountability paradigm, not allowed to use that word with people who they are not willing to take 10 years of mentoring responsibility for another person's outcome. So imagine that you have someone like that in your life. Perhaps you do. I do my best. At some point, you're going to realize that you are that too, and that you'll be able to turn around and look at people that are asking you for help and say, okay, I'll adopt you for at least 10 years and do everything I can to help you without telling you how and why I'm doing it, because that ruins the outcome, because then we're just looking for an answer instead of how to become a different person. It's kind of why I love, well, what's left of Taoism and a lot of indigenous traditions, because they never tell you anything. They just give you some really tricky poetry to figure out. You know, it's like, how many ways can you translate the Tao Te Ching? It's,
Yeah, but I'm starting to realize in a lot of these indigenous cultures, like the hints are everywhere.
yeah, they'll give you some really great questions, but no one's talking about answers. Like,
Yeah. A little side venture, but I'll share you something that I learned in Punjabi.
oh,
So
yeah.
the Punjabi script, the alphabet, like you know how English it sits on the bottom? Like it's like there's lines on the bottom and the letters sit on the bottom, right?
Okay, right.
So in
Oh,
Punjabi,
right.
the Punjabi, the lines on the top and the letters hang from above.
Oh, that's delightful.
Right?
I'm curious if there's anything else we should attend to in our chat.
meaning? Maybe?
It's kind of like how Dantians can be described as having a yolk and a shell, a membrane-like shell, when we learn to do it with the body first.
Okay.
I think meaning is the realization that there's a way to apply ourselves to life that is centered in a kind of peace, that but is willing to face everything that has the potential of the good and bad of life. So when something resonates in me that I would say, man, that's so meaningful, it provides me a sense that I can face something really, really uncomfortable and still be in the eye of my hurricane, still be in the center of the yolk of the egg, still be in my Dantian. I'm not shocked out of it, but are taken to overwhelm. Because that's where meaning, why we, I think meaning is meaningful, is that it kind of lures us without gaslighting into practices and behaviors and paradigms that'll help us face the world without being overwhelmed by it. You're on a path of seeking meaning, as am I, as are most of us. And you ran into what happens when you got somewhere and forgot that it was about the peace, and you started looking for problems. Because that's what makes the meaning seem visceral, right? Hardest, like, as I said before, the hardest part of a spiritual practice is success.
Right.
Because it's so boring. I think I brought this up in the Negong Punk podcast. It's like, most people don't realize this, like around the seventh or sixth grotto or something. It's like, yeah, it's really boring though. Because when you start succeeding at your spiritual practice, there's a lot less problems. There's a lot less things to push your ego through to make sure your ego's still getting it right, because it's hard to move beyond the world of phenomena. I mean, this is really where Nei Gong becomes Nei Dan, is you're no longer interested in the getting anything right or wrong within the existence frame of phenomena, because Nei Dan is reaching into the pre-phenomenal, the preformed, the primordial.
Or like entering paradox land.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you want to go into Natan, you're going to go into the infinite regress when paradoxes will be on paradoxes.
Fractal paradox land.
Which is why I caringly and carefully secure myself around. Well, I'll teach what people nowadays call Negong and a bit of Juji or building the foundation and introduce the Shentai, the immortal fetus kind of relationships to play with. But because I'm still working on teaching teachers and building the, I guess, foundational structures of a contemporary approach to all this stuff that can be explained traditionally in the old kind of hijinks of secret code language, as well as just modern neurophysiology and things like that. If I was to step into the apophatic beyond the contrivance of language, like that'd be cool, but I think I'd probably want to do that in a monastery where tricky poetry and very patient month-long conversations are allowed.
Hashtag goals. So the first time in my life where I actually discovered maybe a sliver of what devotion means was through a specific it was kind of like a Sikh prayer. It's a chant, and so I've gotten into the habit of taking these things and then looking at the English, and then I understand Punjabi, but Gurmukhi, which is like the prayer script, is a little bit different, and then I kind of piece it back together, and then I have enough like background knowledge where I could kind of get the direct translation. So after that process, I get the feeling of it, right? And so there was a specific prayer, which was so in Punjabi it was Bhot janam vichare tere mado eh janma tamare leke. And in English, what I kind of pieced it together, it's like, so many lifetimes I've been separated from you. This lifetime I dedicate it to you. And there's the rest of that too, and there's about other lines there. But I heard that and it just like busted my heart wide open. And then for the next 3 days I had that on repeat, and I'm just like singing it to the sky, and just feeling that like I guess devotional presence of like just like. Yeah, like we've been separated for so long. Who knows how many lifetimes, existences, incarnations, who knows? And then it's like this one, I'm doing it for that,
Yeah.
like
So a few things come to mind.
thing beyond herself.
So we kind of had a conversation about intimacy and how intimacy is the space that's created between you and the lover. And I don't know if you've read Rumi or those guys who talk, about creation, creator as the lover. And that's the problem-solving part of intimacy. Together, in some quality of reunion, we can make the space, room, and hold perhaps the potency or strength or forgiveness and compassion to allow into the space between us the things we don't know about ourselves. And some of those might be positive, passionate, fun, sexy, wild, whatever, woohoo, just to keep us all inspired about the good parts. And then some of it's going to be the shadow. So there's that. But we were talking about intimacy in the context of what you had gone through and how we have to face challenges. So here's the ocean of intimacy that's allowed to have an inlet, of pollution and an inlet of pure water. We find the things about ourselves that we want to celebrate in intimacy that are sacred, and we find out the things about ourselves and each other that are profane. Can't have one without the other. But the ocean of intimacy is the ocean of non-separation, the ocean of love. Now, you said the word devotion, and me being me, the autistic person that loves words, I'm just going to take devotion apart a little bit.
Do it.
Devotion, vo being volition, volition being assertion towards an outcome, which is parallel to the word value. Like value and volition are kind of rooted in the same part of that language, right? So devotion means that I will commit a unspecified period of time towards an outcome of value. right? Shun or Aishun, in those words kind of imply a consistent interaction. So like prayer, like singing, like lovemaking, like being married in a conscious way, there isn't an off switch. So I'm committing my resources and purpose over time to something of value constantly. Right. So in the post-heaven world of phenomena, you can have value and you can have causal time and you can commit both in the same direction. So in that part of practice, devotion is practice. Because you need a why, you need an outcome that's worth not doing all the other things and really, really doing the hardest things. But as you approach kind of that membrane between the phenomenal world and the kind of primordial things that makes the phenomenal world, well, seem real, or take up most of our sense of relevance, devotion doesn't exist because you're beyond separation. Right? So I would say devotion is a great raft to cross rivers, but it has no need in the ocean because you are, again, once again, the ocean itself, which is the outcome of devotion, but it has to be beyond devotion. Right? And that's why we sing in devotion, because we know we'll get to peace and reunion. But you have to have one foot in both worlds most of the time you're here if you have a real practice. So if there's a part of you that's like going, well, devotion, if it's still in the world of phenomena and causality, well, it can't be the real thing, and I want the real thing, and take what you're saying in your mind apart and realize how hilariously separate you have to be from the outcome to have an opinion about how you get there. Because you're not even in the realm of devotion. You're complaining that there's actually a waste of time possible in the devotion because you have a preference beyond how you get there. So this I sorry if I get that I'm sort of throwing a lot of decades and layers at everybody all at once here, but yeah, there's a lot of people who are like radio announcers in the spiritual practice world who just sit there and complain about the terminology, the words, the mishaps, the misconstrued things, the he said, she said of thousands of years of written material. And I don't know, I shyly like to put up my hand and say, what if we look at this the other way? Right? What if we look at this from the past moving into a future towards chaos and just gradually back away slowly, resourcing back into the simplicity of how all these traditions started and start there?
So it's like, how's your breathing?
You're
Are you
in
steady?
state or you're in a story? And if you have a teacher that can help you retain capacity of state shift, state break, who is the one meditating, going deeper through the layers of the kind of constructions of the mind and the pain that's construed by each of those structures of the mind. Now you keep going from story back to state, and then state into deeper state, then state into how state's possible. And now you're actually beginning something. And that takes years. But devotion, with or without the singing, is the only way to get anywhere until there's nowhere again. Because really, when you get going with this stuff, there is no one and there is nowhere. There's no nouns, no thingness.
No thingness.
Okay.
That seems like a good place to leave it there. So thank you to our listeners. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, it's such an honor to do this, and yeah, I'm just very grateful.
Well, all the ancestors are honored that you're knee-deep in the river too. So thanks for walking into the mud with the rest of us.
So thank you, our listeners, and yeah, subscribe, like, comment, all of those things. And yeah, this has been Primordial Tao, Present Tao, episode 13, The Unexpected Intimacy of Inner Cultivation.
Thank you for exploring and enjoying Primordial Tao, Present Tao. We look forward to sharing more in the next episode.